testing. Well, if you can't do it, there's the other way I can adjust it.
If you want to, I'm sorry about that.
That's all right. I've done things this way before.
Uh-huh. Okay. You ready again?
Yeah.
Okay. Good morning, everybody. This morning's tutorial is presented by Ted Cho. We've been fortunate to have Ted attend a couple of previous...
Okay, can everyone hear me?
Great.
Okay, so it's a class that basically, to hear me come up and prattle about the subject, I decided to frame it in a way that might cause people to, you know, be somewhat interested in the topic. Oh, it's really clever. To advance it. Many of you have probably had that sinking feeling when you type something like RM star dash RF, or you hear this funny clicking noise from your laptop and your heart starts sinking. And so mainly what we're here to talk about is, you know, what does actually happen when your data disappears, and of course what happens in order to keep the data there. I'll give you a quick hint: backups. Did I mention backups? Backups. Good idea. So anyway, that's a short 11 o'clock. Feel free to ask me questions. Depending on how we go for time, I may have to defer the answer until the break or the end of the class. Normally, I've actually given this class, and it's taken likely pretty much matches with the goals for this class. So let's first talk about how does data actually get lost. Anyone know what PBAC stands for? Number one cause of errors, and there are all sorts of different types. One of my favorite was a consultant at MIT who was trying to tell a student how to delete a file and concept of double quotes. So he said, why don't you type RM star space dash I and keep saying no until you get to the file with the space in it and say yes. That was that. So there are all sorts of different types of user goofs, and we've probably seen all of these before. Users are infallible, so softwares never have mistakes in them. Depending on the different types of failures, the mistake will cause problems in different places. Will be file-level corruptions, DB database getting corrupted, subversion database getting corrupted, whatnot. The challenge with software failures is you want to discover the problem as soon as possible. And number two, and probably more importantly, is so that you don't actually make the problem worse, contaminate additional files, or send out in where usually, not always, but usually you know that you screwed up right after you hit the enter key. Software bugs tend to be more subtle. And again, hardware bugs, you drop a laptop, pieces go flying everywhere, it's really obvious. All sorts of different types of hardware failures. You can have data corruption due to memory errors, bits that are actually flipped during hardware is crap. You get what you pay for. Pre-IDE UDMA, the IDE bus had no data integrity checks at all, which is okay because the PCI bus doesn't do parity disk. Don't worry, you'll never know what hit you. SCSI at least has a parity bit, so you get single bit, you can detect single bit errors. Most people are using cheap memory that doesn't do ECC, so again, you'll never know what hit you. One of the more scary errors is when the bit doesn't get flipped in the data, but gets flipped in the address, right? So you get a disk block written to the run. And of course, you can have actual problems with the hard drive itself, hard disk crashes, what have you. So all sorts of different types of... first rule is basically ancient ancient Greek physician, right? First, do no harm, right? Figure out what happened, right? Before you do anything else, create backups, all right? Because that way, if you try to do things to fix things up, you won't make things worse. A particularly really good idea. This is a really simple way of doing it. I'll talk about a slightly better way in later on the talk, but you know, just so that we have a simple way of doing it, the famous DD command input. If you think about you know how much it costs for a 200 gig disk drive compared to the value of probably what's on that disk drive, how much time it would take to reconstruct. Buying another disk, cheap insurance, so if that happens, buying another disk is a really good idea. You can back it up to a file if you've got free space somewhere, but very often the easiest thing to do is just simply you know back it up to another. That 1K, but we won't lose anything else. If you use a larger block size, then if DD runs into an error, you know it will just lose, say, the 8K chunk if you're using an 8K block size. Thing is that last bit, conv sync, comma, no error. Okay, what no error means is when DD runs into IO error, instead of stopping, it will just simply continue. And what sync means is it will write a block, that block, it will ignore the bad block and then just keep going, and then the output file won't be synced up to the input file. So conv sync conv. So that was sort of the quick what to do in case of problems. Now what we're going to do is dive a bit deeper about how data is actually stored on disk. Because when LVM, if you're using LVM, the file system structure. So we're going to go through each of these in greater detail, and then we're going to come back and talk about, so this is a very, very quick how do hard drives work, and it's from the perspective of someone who uses hard drives, right? If any, take you warmly by the throat, but, just kidding. But most of the time we don't really care about what is actually going on underneath. It's an interesting subject, if nothing else. This is just, however, a very, very simplified view of what actually happens with a hard drive. So what's actually in a hard drive? Sealed enclosures, I suspect most of you know, is that the disk is going to be spinning at anything up to 10,000. So compared to the distance, that air gap, between the read-write heads and the disk platter, even a tiny little dust particle is going to look like a gigantic boulder, and it's going to do like massive amounts of damage. And that can cause some pretty nasty damage. We'll have a motor. In old-fashioned disk drives, it would be a stepper motor, direct location on the track. And then there's a controller on the hard drive itself that will either be speaking a TAPI IDE or speaking SCSI commands. And it will actually coordinate the whole shebang and make things go. Heads actually will be resting on the platter when the hard drive is actually shut down. There are actually springs that physically force the heads. The air actually gets dragged along the surface of the platter. And then that air creates an aerodynamic effect that pushes the head above the platter. So the head is, in fact, actually held above the platter. All right, and that's a very, very delicate balance. Now, if anything happens where the head scrapes against the platter, but that's what's called a head crash. And there are all sorts of things that can cause a head crash. Actually, every single time you shut down the system, you actually will the head will actually come to rest on the platter before it actually rests against the platter. So, as I was saying, on a controlled shutdown, it's in power save mode, so it spins down the hard drive, it will actually stop the drive. That, however, only protects the platter. Every single time a hard drive spins up or spins spinning fast enough that you get the air cushion, and that actually pushes the head above the platter, which means every single time the drive starts or stops, you're ending in takeoff cycles. Before the probability of failure is roughly 50%. So what does this mean? Well, if you want your hard drive to last as long as single time you stop the motor, the heads are dragging against the platter, obviously you don't want that to happen, and that's the reason for some of the recommendations a little bit more complicated. First of all, the environmentalists, the Greens, care about saving power. If you actually look at how much power is used in a typical data center, it's actually pretty staggering. It's usually not in use just to simply save power, you know, save carbon dioxide, you know, keep the polar caps from melting, you know, all that good stuff. The other drive, which when multiplied by several million disk drives is, you know, real money, those disks very often will not have spindle motors that are designed for continuous operation. So the ball bearings aren't up to snuff, or adequate heat sinks, so you can actually dissipate the heat if the disk drive is actually running all the time. And that's one of the reasons why Apple actually had HUD was designed to save power, and so it was designed to only spin up the hard drive every few minutes, and it would read the next chunk of music, and then it would shut the hard drive down. And if you tried to use the IO, you actually increase the life of a hard drive. It gets a little bit trickier on modern-day systems. Smashes against the spinning platter. You can actually scrape off iron oxide. All right. Now, once you do that, that iron oxide becomes the equivalent of dust. Right. And remember how we said dust in the enclosure, and they bounce against the spinning platter, they get accelerated even faster. Now, there are these devices that are supposed to catch any dust particles that end up flying around inside the filter. Those devices won't catch them all. And sooner or later, one of them will actually hit the disk drive, and then the disk drive may end up causing another crash, which will cause more iron oxide to be scraped off the platters. And I recommend that the moment you see a few disk errors, particularly on modern hard drives, which have all of this automatic another one, and maybe another hour later you see two or three, that should be a hint. Right? That's the disk drive saying, you know those backups you've been putting off for the last 6 months? There was one time when I was on a train, and I dropped my laptop, and this was a T21, so it was one of the older things. You know, time to do a backup before things got really bad. So, something to watch out for. Okay. In the good old days, the big 8-inch platter hard drives, you'd have some number of platters, and on the really, really old platters, if you had four platters, you use one side of one of the disk platters as a control surface. And instead of using a stepper motor, which would mechanically just sort of chunk the head, one track position, for each electrical, would be a control surface that would actually tell you where you were on the heads, and that was used to actually calibrate the motor. So you could actually, in the really, really old days, move the head to a particular track. There would be a fixed number of sectors per track. The old floppy disks still work that way, although I think more and more people aren't even remembering what floppy disks are. Using a cylinder, which was basically just simply another name for the track number, which head, and then which sector into boot programs, and so we have this legacy that we just sort of assume that things are still using the cylinder head sector scheme. Modern disks don't do anything like this. Looked at, and this was probably about 2 years ago, instead of actually having a single track, they would have bands. And within that bands, they would have these ahead forward, and then the track would actually be this concentric spiral. And you would have these zones of concentric spirals, and that was how data was actually laid out, and there was probably some really clever reason why they laid it out that way. But they had to keep the old cylinder head sector addressing scheme, but any concept of, and if you looked at some of the older BSD file systems, they would talk about cylinder groups, and they would actually go through amazing amounts of efforts to try to actually keep everything on one cylinder so that at least in theory you could read stuff. Information is all just essentially made up. About the only thing that you can rely upon is that if you have two block numbers that are close to, but even that is subject to some adjustments because modern disk drives do bad block replacement. So even though you have two blocks that look like they might be close together, if there was a bad block in that block, there's nothing you can do about that, so we just simply don't worry about it. But, you know, that's just simply life. So that's sort of the very, very quick. Partition's pretty simple. Goal is to take a single large drive and divide it into smaller units, possibly for file systems, possibly for other things. There are lots of different ways of doing it, basically so on and so forth. We're going to talk about two. The first is the what you would find on, and the entire partition table is stored on 512 bytes. And in fact, it's worse than that. It's stored in the last 64 bytes of the partition. And that's the breakout. There are a couple of interesting things about this that I'll just, you know, point out. First of all, the starting row above 2 terabytes, because if you're addressing using 32 bits and your unit of measure is 512 byte sectors, you run into problems fairly quickly. The information is also stored twice of the old cylinder head sector using this weird PAC 3-byte format. Different operators, that's what the BIOS routines use, and if you're writing a bootloader that's calling the BIOS routines, you have to pass it the cylinder head sector fantasy, even though it has nothing to do with reality. Linux, once you're actually booted into Linux, only pays attention to what the geometry actually is. You know, how many cylinders, how many heads, how many sectors are really on that hard drive. Given that it's a fantasy, it can be anything at all, but you have to do a good job. You know, that's just, you know, one of the things that's make this kind of ugly. In addition, we don't know necessarily what are in those partitions. There's a 1-byte type field, for the most part, Linux mostly ignores the type byte. The only time Linux uses table. Yeah. Yeah, that's one of the places. Almost lost my laptop during that first session. There's a convention about the starting locus to figure out what the cylinder head sector is for that particular partition. Some BIOSes use that. Some BIOSes actually ask the hard drive, which will provide some fantasy answer, which hopefully matches with the fantasy answer that's here of the first partition to actually get you that information. And the reason is there's no other place to store the information, right? There's no header, there's no version number. That's right. Now, you know, we've talked about some of the problems already. One of the problems is that if you do have a 200 gig hard drive or something. With a large disk, you might want to have more subdivisions than just 4. And so one of the tricks that you can do with the MBR is you can have an extended partition. All right. Now, an extended partition will have at the beginning this 500 last 64 bytes to contain either one or two partition entries, where the first entry will be a venue. A picture is probably the best way to demonstrate what the heck is actually going on. And here I'm using the Linux device names, and we have three primary partitions, HDA1, HDA2, HDA2, is the extended partition, and that first red stripe there would be the first extended boot record. And that extended boot record will have a green stripe on top. And that second extended partition will have another extended partition table entry. That extended partition table entry will contain, in this particular case, the information for HDA. Yeah, each one of these, they're still using that 16-byte entry, so you've got that the beginning of that extended partition. So you can actually store bigger partitions because the offsets, start at that point. But it just simply gets very, very ugly if you want to do things that way. This is a linked list, right? in order to find the location of that extended stripe, you have to find this extended boot record and then use the other extended boot record. You won't be able to find the starting points of any of the other partitions except by doing a brute force search, looking for 512 byte sectors that looking for this magic number. All right, that's what GPark does. Among that partition, if that linked list gets snapped, that's the only way you can actually find the rest. And of course, you can have false positives if you have other data blocks that happen to end in this really, really small magic number, but that's just the way life goes. You use a 512 byte sector every single time you create version of what was it, the 2002 or 2003 version of TurboTax that had copy protection software. I think they were sticking information in some of these places. So there might be some copy protection software that was sneaking stuff. Yes. Yeah, you could. So, problems with the MBR, I've sort of talked about some of these already. You have a one, Linux certainly didn't for the most part. And since no one was paying attention to it, it had the tendency to get even more wrong. Because we're using this nested MBR structure for extended partitions, it was very fragile. If anything broke, you ended up losing. If one of them is wrong, you could have some really, really confusing effects. And the fields are too small for modern disk drives. Popular. But when Intel actually designed this partition table, they were basically designing what they were hoping would be the next generation partition table. And they were actually hoping that it's called EFI for extended firmware interface, because that was the specification where this first appeared. That never in a data center somewhere. And also because it's an example of how to actually do partition tables right. And maybe someday we'll actually see a sanely designed partition table in common use. I'm not holding my breath. The partition table is actually stored twice on the disk, so you actually have redundancy. What a concept. We actually use larger field of figuring out what a partition might actually contain. That may seem trivial, but it will prevent a whole lot of user errors where you accidentally delete the wrong partition, because this is what the GUID partition table contains. I'm not going to go through this in a huge amount of detail, but some of the interesting highlights are we use an index, all right? So it knows whether or not any of these fields are corrupted. And in fact, the way the system actually works is you always write the primary first, and then if the CRCs are not correct, then the system was in the middle of updating the partition table when it crashed. So you have to use the backups, and then you cop the backups, and then copy from the master to the backup if the backups are older, so that you always maintain two consistent partition tables. Each entry for a globally unique ID. You may also know this as a UUID, and it's a 16-byte number, and you can think of it as a completely random. This is 128 bits. That's a very, very large number. The chances that you will get a collision are essentially remote. And so if you create a new file system type, all you need to do to get a new partition for Linux swap, for the Linux boot sector, that are defined in the specification, and if you do a new file system, you just simply generate a new designed to be unique for computer purposes. But then there's also a 72-byte human-readable partition name. So that's actually for the system and sysadmin to figure out what's going on. An LBA format, we just completely ignore the old cylinder head sector format. So that's what a GUID partition table looks like. Sector, we have a legacy master boot record. And the only reason why that's there is it contains a fake partition table entry so that a confused Windows partition table software won't blow away against legacy software. Then we have the GUID partition table header, which is in sector one. And then as many And so the data is replicated, and as I mentioned earlier, when you're reading from the partition table, they have this very strictly defined protocol where you always read the master first, check from the backup, and copy to the master. It's a very, very strict protocol for how you read from it, so you can actually do atomic updates to the... And there are multiple ways that you can do partition tables. These were just simply two simple ways. Solaris has their own scheme, BSD has their own scheme. Almost any of them are better than the old MBR system, but, okay, so the question is, can you elect to use the GUID scheme? You can sort of. Only knows how to look at the legacy master boot record. So it would be possible to set up a disk where the legacy master boot record is just correct enough so that you can actually... on the other hand, if you actually try to use that system on a Windows system, a Windows x86 system will get horribly confused. Comment in the back, Peter? Yeah, we'll have to see how things work out. If you're using gotchas, is the BIOS only loads the first 512 byte sector. And if you're doing this on an Itanium system where you have a partition table format, and in the extended firmware specifications, there is a special GUID partition, which is your boot partition, where you can actually load a more complicated second stage bootloader. And it would be tricky unless you basically do the cheat that we do with LILO and the grub stage one loader, where you actually hard code the block numbers in your stage one boot question. Well, okay, the port code so the bootloader can more easily, utilize this particular scheme. Flexible, but it's more complicated, right? And in an embedded environment where you control the horizontal and you control the vertical, it may matter, it may not, right? That's more of an individual taste question than anything else. I'm not going to say you have to do it the more control. The limitations of the MBR probably won't be a problem unless you actually have 2 terabyte disks, which, maybe not so likely. LVMs, basically it's a logical extension of a partition table. Right. So you can think of with the partition table, you had a disk which was subdivided into partitions, which we will now call a volume group, and we'll use those volume groups subdivided and create a logical volume. The additional disk and logical volumes don't have to be contiguous like they have to be with a partition. In fact, they can be randomly scattered across the disk, and that allows you to resize logical volumes. It has to do wholesale data moving if it wants to expand a partition, and there isn't free space at the very end of the partition, because in a partition table scheme, all of your software, you may have additional features beyond that. For example, you might be able to move a logical volume from one disk or one set of disks to another set of disks while they're in use. So you can actually sweep through SMART or through some other means. You can actually, while the system is running without taking it down, sweep those logical volumes off to another disk. And then many modern LVMs will also have snapshot capability. And in cooperation with the file system, it will allow you to snapshot the state of the disk so you can get a consistent snapshot if you want to do a consistency check. So this is a very, very quick intro to LVMs. I suspect many of you are familiar with this already, or if not, there's some really good LVM how-tos that will go, and the logical volumes that are created out